Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Freedom Nation podcast with Jeff Kickle. And today's show, I've got Simon on. Simon is from England. He is an expert in investing in gold, and we're going to have a good conversation about that today. We've had a couple folks on that have talked about gold in the past. Hadn't had anybody on since the gold market's been taking a little bit of a whack. Due to the Iran situation, and it's certainly been a fun place to invest, or an interesting place, not necessarily fun. So stay tuned. We'll be right back on in just a second.
Welcome to the Freedom Nation Podcast with Jeff Kickle. On this show, Jeff shares his expertise in financial and retirement planning from a different perspective. Planning for your Freedom Day, which is the first day that you wake up and have enough income or assets and do not have to go to work that day. Learn how to calculate what you need, how to generate income sources, and listen to interviews from others who've done it themselves. Get ready to experience your own Freedom Day.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Simon, how are you, my friend?
I'm fantastic. Great to be here.
Glad to have you on. Look forward to the conversation today. Why don't we get started with telling us a little bit about your story? How did you get to where you're at today and what you're doing?
Right. Well, I mean, I started out sort of doing the typical MBA investment banking. I saw friends earning a lot of money in property, working half the hours I did. So I switched from corporate finance and investment banking to property. I ran a development fund, also a commercial property fund. And after a few years, I thought, well, you know, I want to sort of pick my career for the next 15, 20 years. And if I'm honest, I got out of property probably, well, definitely 10 years too early, might have even been 15 years too early. But I've made some good money from it, and I saw commodities as the future, in particular gold, because I saw it as a way of trying to beat inflation and get some very good returns. And what I also noticed, there's no one in the market teaching people how to invest in gold. And I don't think that there is today, which is obviously what I do. But there's an amazing market for gold, and it's crazy. You know, people want to win the gold medal. They want to enjoy their golden years. They don't want their partner to marry a gold digger. You see children with grandparents that say, oh, they've been as good as gold. It's kind of in our everyday language. But if you speak to most people and say, oh, do you have any gold? They're like, oh, well, no, I don't. And so part of what I'm trying to do is get the story out there and change that.
That's awesome. It was funny when I knew I had this conversation, or I was having this conversation, that I was walking past one of my bookshelves and I just happened to see Jim Rogers' book, Hot Commodities. And I was like, you know what? it was meant to be today to have this conversation. Yeah. Jim is one of my favorite investors of all time. I mean, he's just, you know, he worked for one of the most evil people that I think is on the planet, but genuinely one of the best investment minds, I think, and somebody who could think so far beyond the rest of us that just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, no, I read that book. It's a fantastic book. And, you know, I teach people about gold. Perhaps if they're a bit more advanced, you know, we talk about silver, uranium, copper, and other things like that. But yeah, you can't, you know, you've got to walk before you can run. And you know, people should at least learn how to invest in gold. And it's not, you can have a strategy about it and you can do it in a certain way where you can manage your risk. And it's what I say to people is you can make some smart decisions and have a bad outcome, or you can make some stupid decisions and have a good outcome. A bit like, you know, a sports person could have a really good game but be on the losing side, or have a really bad game and be on the winning side. And what I try and teach people is how to kind of be on the winning side, because I think that at the end of the day, that's what we want. We want at the end of a season, you look at who won the league. You don't necessarily, you perhaps know a few of the star players, but you probably, unless you're an ardent fan, you don't know all of them. And it's the same with investing. You know, if you have a portfolio, you'll know a few of the companies, but you probably won't know all of them. And I can assure you that even if you pick some good ones, you will definitely pick some bad ones as well. So don't expect them all to be winners.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did you initially get into it more as your own investment and then started moving into, you know, working with clients and educating, or did you just kind of make that step right in?
I started with my own investing, if I'm honest. I did very well. And there's a magazine here in the UK called Money Week.
Okay.
And they kind of approached me and said, oh, you know, I hear you're doing well in gold and commodities. Can you write a newsletter for us? And I was like, yeah, I'll do that. So I wrote a newsletter. One of my companies, Chalice, went up over 8,000%. Absolutely crazy returns. And then when they sold it, a Money Week used to be owned by Gora. When it was sold, they asked me to stay on, and I wrote a publication called Gold Speculator.
Okay.
There was a guy in the US who wrote it, and I wrote it outside the US. And again, that was kind of tipping gold companies. And so that's how I kind of got into it. But I was obviously investing my own money on the side. And not only was I doing that, but I was learning about the gold market at the same time. You know, I sit on the board of Resourcing Tomorrow, which is one of the world's largest event managers for mining companies. And I sit on the board of another company as their gold expert, and I'm used by various organizations as their gold expert. So it kind of sucks you in. You start off saying, I want to do this, and then we always like to think we're in control, but we're not. You know, you end up sort of being pushed and pulled in various directions, and I ended up being, you know, Mr. Gold.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's always about being that specialist that you can share your expertise. So let's talk a little bit about gold investing, because I think a lot of people don't really get it. You know, they might buy some gold coins. They might have the GLD fund here in the United States, the ETF for gold. Not a lot of people, I think, invest in gold stocks per se. So kind of let's talk about your approach to this and how you see this kind of fitting in with people's portfolios.
Yeah, sure. Well, look, I think there's lots of different ways to invest in gold. Mm-hmm. You can get physical gold, you can get funds, then you can get, you know, you talk about companies. There's lots of different types of companies. There's massive multinational companies. I use a fantasy football analogy, so I'd have that as a goalkeeper. And then I'd have a very large but more national or focused on a particular commodity company as a defender. I'd have a newer producer as a midfielder, and I'd have an explorer as a forward. And I think that when you build a portfolio, one of the problems you have is a lot of people, they kind of start at the wrong end. They think, oh, you know, I want to get this 10,000% return. I'm going to get forwards. And forwards, I describe them more as a bet than an investment. Mm-hmm. And yes, you can get lucky and you can win, but chances are you'll be unlucky and you'll lose. And so I had actually come at it from the other end. I'd say to people, look, get some physical gold. You know, if you've got enough money, get a fund. And then perhaps you've got enough money, get a goalkeeper, and then build forward. And it's amazing. I mean, I've got one of my clients on physical gold has made well over 130%. I mean, he sold a whole load, so we can't work out exactly what he's made because He's now got double the amount that he invested, and he's already taken a hell of a lot out. So we can't work out. Well, we probably can, but it will take quite a lot of analysis. But basically, by investing in physical gold, not only can you get a good return, but it's also like a proxy for cash. Mm-hmm. Because I'd say you need to invest it for at least a year, because you've got cost of buying, which varies enormously, but I use 4% as a kind of, in my head, 0.5% for storage and insurance, and then 4% to sell it. You can probably get it less than that, but that's, you know, if you've got those numbers
that's,
in your head.
That's on the high end of everything, and if you can make it with that, then you're fine, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, if you buy a lot, you get like a bulk discount and things like that. You can probably get it for, you know, 3.5, 3.25, whatever it is. But the point is that if you're going to do this, you kind of need to do it for at least a year. And if you've got listeners who are, let's say, a little bit older and they've got a pension, a lot of pension funds can accept bullion. And it has to be qualified bullion, but whoever manages your pension fund can tell you, you know, what you can and can't have. And gold in sterling terms has delivered a return of over 10.6% per year on average over the last 25, 26 years between 2000 and 2026. I'm not sure what the number is in the US, but it's not massively similar. It's probably...
It's basically that, yeah, because, I mean, most of it's dollar denominated as it is, so...
Well, exactly. What I like about it is, I mean... Everyone's got their own opinion on what inflation is, but all I'd say is 10.6 is a lot higher than inflation, whatever calculation people are using. Yeah. And so just by getting some physical gold, and this is ignoring, you know, your funds and your companies and stuff like that, but just by getting physical gold, you stand a decent chance of not only outpacing inflation, but also making money. And not only making money, but also having liquid money. And what I find is the first, you know, obviously depends on the market, but the first year, if you're lucky, it can be the first 2 months. If you're unlucky, it can be the first couple of years. You're kind of, you can find yourself in a losing situation where you bought gold and, you know, say you bought $10,000 worth, it might be worth 9,000. But I think that's, you know, I'd describe that as unlucky. And one of the reasons I say don't do it for less than a year is the last thing you want is to need that money and you have to sell it. You know, what I would say to people is, look, you know, if it's gone from 10 to 9, there's no guarantees, but, you know, hopefully it'll go back up to 11 or 12. And so, you know, you're kind of the following year, you've got money. So, but I think certainly for the older generation, it's also divisible, which is, you know, people who want to, let's say, contribute towards their grandkids' education or help them get a car or help them get a deposit on a house. Having worked in real estate, don't get me wrong, I love it. You know, I've done very well out of it. But If you buy a house, you know, I'm not sure what it is in the US, but let's say, I know, $500,000 is a house. If you need $20,000 to buy a car, you can't just sell the garage or the spare bedroom. You've got to sell the whole house. And so you needed $20,000 and you've had to sell something worth $500,000. And, you know, what do you do with that? Do you put it back in the property? You know, you've got way more money than you need. Yeah. And with gold, what you could do is you could let's say have the same amount of money. Let's say you've got $500,000, but you could have it in bars that are worth $10,000. Yeah. And so, if you need money to pay for a grandkid's education, whatever it is, you sell one bar and you keep the rest. And I think that's kind of, especially if the property market flattens or goes down, that's incredibly useful to have. And not only is it divisible, but there's a kind of an element of certainty about it. I mean, if I said, Jeff, you know, you owe me $500,000, you go, oh, I've got this house, you know, it's worth $500,000. And I'm like, okay, well, you sell that and you give me my $500,000 back. And you're like, I've got a buyer for it. They're going to give me $500,000. That deal can always fall through, especially in a falling market. You know, it might be that it takes 6 months to sell it. And by the time it comes to sell it, the buyer goes, well, actually, Jeff, that property is only worth $490. So I'm going to give you $490 for it. And you go, well, we agreed $500. Yeah, I know we did, but I can get it $490. And
I can find one down the street that I can get for $490. And
well, exactly. And then, you know, what do you do? You either say, okay, well, Simon, I can give you $490 of the $500 and I'll give you the other 10 as soon as I can. Or you say to the guy, no, jog on, I want $500. That's what we agreed. And then you find yourself in a situation where you get it valued again and the guy goes, actually, yeah, no, it's $490. And you're like, oh, damn. Okay, so you have to list it at $490 and then you have the same problem. You know, someone at the last minute goes, I'll give you $480 for it. And you're like, yeah, and if you're not careful, you know, if the market really goes down, you end up chasing the market down and you could end up getting...
Well, we saw this, I mean, and you saw it in England too. I mean, 2007 to 2010, I mean, if you were relying on your house as a place of value, it was not by any way, shape or form, and you couldn't unload them at the time.
Well, that's it. And I think there's a kind of, it's very important for people to realize that your house is your home. You know, you live in it. And it's kind of like, yes, it could be worth a lot of money, but you know, your children probably go to a school within walking distance of it and things like that. And so, if you turn around and say, okay, well, I've got a house that's worth, let's say $1 million, and I'm going to sell it, then I can pay off my debts. You've then got to find somewhere that's large enough for your family. It's in the same area because they don't have to move schools and stuff. And you've got all the costs of moving and, you know, stamp duty and everything like that. And so you might have $1 million, but you have to look at something that's worth, let's say, $700, which is, I don't know, it's quite a step down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do I like property? Yes, I do. But do I see it as a long-term solution for wealth? No, I don't. You know, I think it's useful to have it as part of your portfolio, but I wouldn't have it as 100% of my portfolio. And I know that certain people do, and I wouldn't advocate that at all.
No, I wouldn't either. No, and I mean, you know, you've got to have a multitude, and you know, even if you have gold in your portfolio, that's not the solution to everything either. You know, it needs to be a mix of several things. You know, you need to have things that are based on, you know, and I mean, even within a gold portfolio, you have, you know, the bullion itself, you have funds, you have individual stocks, you know, within there. All of that can be its own little, you know, piece of the pie, so to speak.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and I'm a great believer in diversification, not just within investing in gold, but as you say, you know, you want to have lots of different assets. And you know, one of the things I say about gold is, you know, if you're giving gold to someone, I've never heard a grandkid or a kid say, "Oh no, I don't want that. No, don't give me that gold." You know, obviously, you don't want your children to go and live somewhere else, but there comes a point where you're too old to manage a property, and if it's in your local town, it can be a pain in the backside dealing with tenants, especially with changes in the law and, you know, changes in tax and things like that. And you probably don't want that hassle. And I think that you kind of do need to put a price on that hassle. And now, people they can have sleepless nights with tenants, and I've been on holiday with friends who've had the phone go, and they've been on a sun lounger, and there's been a tap burst in one of their rental properties, and they're like, "Oh God, you know, can't you just get a plumber to fix it?" And they're like, "Well, who do we use?" And yeah. they then spend half a day trying to get the local plumber out. And he's busy, so they end up paying a fortune to get someone to do it out of hours. And it's kind of like...
Hire a property manager. Don't mess with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's one of the things I love about gold. You know, you don't have tenants, to be honest.
No.
And
no.
I do love property. I've done very well at it. But there are certain things with property that I think are particularly helpful.
Hmm. So let's talk a little bit about gold. We peaked, I think, right around the end of January this year, after a pretty good run throughout 2025. And it's been kind of on a steady decline for, I was just looking at a chart of the GLD, and it just now hit where we were. We're just now back to where we were in November, looks like mid-October. We had a little bit of a spike and then we pulled back for the holidays. We've just now gotten back to that this year. What do you see going on in the gold market? What do you see were some of the effects to, as an expert, what have been some of the effects to cause it to come back down like it has been?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I use an acronym called MIDI, which is market uncertainty, interest rates, debt, and inflation, which I think those are the four things that drive the gold price. And a lot of people go, well, you know, there was a war in Iran, you know, that's massive market uncertainty, the price crashed. But I think what people need to understand is the difference between long-term and short-term. I think long-term market uncertainty is going to cause the price of gold to increase. And If you're a long-term investor, we'll say long-term, I'm talking more than a year, that market uncertainty is definitely helping gold. But when you have, let's say, like an Iran crisis, the price does plummet because everyone needs cash.
Yep.
And if you need cash, you sell what you can, not what you want. And gold is so liquid. What happens is you end up with a whole lot of people selling gold to raise cash. So you have a massive supply of gold hitting the market, and the price is bound to go down. So I think that's the reason why the gold price has moved down. I view it as a short-term thing. And is it going to go up from here? Yes, I think it will. But it goes up and down, you know, and I've got some charts on my website that indicate that, you know, the gold price could do phenomenally well, but it ain't going to do that. It'll do that. And so if people are going to invest in the market, I don't think it's a short-term thing. I think you invest, you know, I always say to people, you can't control the market, but you can control how you invest. And I would never say to anyone, now's the low, put all your money in. You know, I would say, perhaps split your money into four or whatever and put some in now, some in 3 months, some in another 3 months, some in another 3 months. And after each investment, one of three things will happen. The price will go up and you may think, well, I don't want to invest anymore because, you know, I've already made whatever percent. Or the price will go down and you go, okay, well, that's good. I've still got half my money and, you know, I'll buy it at a cheaper price and I still believe in gold, or the price will stay the same, you know, and you just put more in. So I think it's certainly a market you want exposure to. You know, as we said earlier, you know, I don't advocate having all your money in anything. I think having a proportion of your money in gold and commodities makes sense. But a lot of people have got none, and I think that's wrong.
Yeah. Well, and I totally agree with you. I mean, I look at it from a chartist perspective, and, you know, we're just that far from being back to the 200-day moving average, which, you know, for me, that tells me, okay, we're moving in the right direction. Right around the time that a lot of this stuff hopefully is clearing up in the Middle East, hopefully, you know, oil starts moving through the the Straits of Hormuz again, much easier, and commerce, period, which, you know, I think a lot of the big central banks were selling gold just to generate cash so that they could buy whatever in these cases. So, I would foresee, from my point of view, I think, you know, the central banks aren't going to be stopping buying gold for their coffers anytime soon. And so once we're back to kind of normal world, I could see it clearly, just kind of cranking back up a little bit on the upside.
I couldn't agree more. I think the key is investing for at least a year. And
yeah,
I think that I've got my family in gold, my daughter's money I put in gold. But I know that, some of them have said to me recently, do you think we should sell? The price has come down. We made a lot of money last year. And I'm like, no, just keep it. And they're like, what are you doing? And I said, I'm keeping it. And they're like, oh, okay. Yeah. But it's kind of like, in the nicest possible way, what I'm doing is kind of irrelevant to you. It's kind of like, if I'm selling it, I'm only selling it because I need the money for something else, which I don't. But it's kind of like, long term, over a year, I think gold could be incredibly important for people in their portfolio.
I agree. Just before we kind of transition to the fast five questions, can you tell me a little bit about the actual miner side of it? So, we talked about gold, but when we talked about miners, what are some of the effects that we see? And, a lot of them have been at multiples higher on the downside in the miners. What has had such an effect on them when gold's gone down? Because, from what I've seen in the miners recently, it's almost like 2 to 3x. If gold goes up 2%, the miners might go up 4 to 6. If gold goes down 2%, the miners are down 6 to 8%. So why have they been a little bit more, I guess, leveraged to the gold market at this point?
Yeah, look, it's really simple. And you're absolutely spot on. You get a lot of volatility in the gold price and the gold miners. And obviously, you've got the S&P, it's doing whatever it's doing. But with a gold miner, costs broadly stay the same, okay? And I'm talking about all in sustainable costs. So your costs of finding it, fuel costs, your labor costs, transportation costs, all those costs, they move around, but broadly they stay the same. So what you've got is you've got quite a large fixed cost, and then you've got the gold price above it. Now, if the gold price comes down, your costs stay the same. So your margin comes down dramatically, and therefore the share price comes down dramatically. If the gold price increases, your costs broadly stay the same, but your margin explodes, and so the share price goes up dramatically. So it's a lot about the cost base in terms of what causes the volatility, which I think is... there's lots of other reasons as well. That's a massive generalization. You could have a gold company that makes a massive discovery, or you could have a gold company that has a massive problem with either processing or a rockfall or something. But broadly speaking, if you see the gold price go up and you think it's going to continue going up, then what I say to people is, look, just get gold. But also, some of these mining stocks, you can get ridiculous returns. And you can get ridiculous returns just off producers. You don't have to go take the massive risk of explorers. Yeah, an explorer, you get a 10,000% return, but you don't need to take that risk. You can still get a really fabulous return off a producer. And if you're prepared to go with a smaller producer, and I teach people how to make selections and how to, how to kind of not only build a portfolio, but how to select companies to put into your portfolio. Then you can make a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah. That's pretty impressive. All right. Well, let's transition to the fast five questions now. Ready?
Go on. Go on. If I'm honest, I looked at them about two weeks ago, but I haven't looked at them. No. So what you're getting is 100% honest answers. I wish I'd prepared something, but I haven't.
It's the best kind, best answer. All right. First question. You wake up in the morning. Business is gone. You have $500 in your pocket, a laptop computer, a place to live, food and clothing. What are you going to do first?
I've got no dog to feed, no cat to feed. That's good. I would say,
and even if you did, you'd have the food for them, so you're fine.
Okay, $500. I would use my computer to tell everyone in the world what I do and why they should speak to me, and the $500. Hopefully, I wouldn't need that day, but everyone needs or should have some gold in their portfolio. A lot of people don't. So I think one of the first things I would do is to spend the money on a website and target people probably through social media. I've got about almost 23,000 followers on LinkedIn. Nice. And I would make sure people knew how to get hold of me if they wanted to learn about investing in gold.
I like
so
that.
That's what I like do with your first question.
That's your strategy. I love it. All right. Next question. What is the biggest business mistake you've ever made?
Ooh, yeah. I can't believe you make us do this on video. That's so unfair. biggest business mistake. Investing in the wrong company. And I would say not only investing in the wrong company, but taking a tip. So not doing proper research. So taking a tip, putting a load of money into a company because someone said, hey, this is a good company to invest in. Dumb as a post doing that, because when it doesn't work out, that person, I can assure you, you won't see them for dust. And you kind of kick yourself because you've got all the money invested, then you start looking at the company, and quite often there's press releases and whatever coming out, and you're like, oh my God, I've invested in this. And so not researching a situation before investing, I think, is probably a massive mistake I've made. And I've done it on a couple of occasions, to be honest. It's not just once. I've probably done it twice, maybe even three times.
My worst is the listening, because I typically don't listen to the financial media ever. I drive to work and I listen for just a little bit, and then I don't really pay attention throughout most of the day, and I may catch something at the end of the day. But listening to, oh, this great company, you know, oh, here's what we're doing, and I fall for it and end up getting bitten by the bug of the TV personality. So
that's so true. Actually, I met one of the world's top fund managers, and it was quite interesting because he was being interviewed by someone who managed billions, if not trillions, of money. And they said, so, you know, how do you analyze a company? How can you be so good? You must meet the managers and all that. And he said, no, I never meet the managers. And the guy goes, really? And he said, no, I never meet the managers, because a manager could be a really good salesperson.
Yeah.
In which case, I'm investing in him, and even though his company might be awful, the manager could be a terrible salesperson. And, I don't invest in the company, and I should be. So, again, that's a lesson I learned, unfortunately, at the same time as my tip thing. But always, always, always have a look at it yourself and, form your own view. And if you're not capable of doing that, learn how to do some basic analysis. And I teach people how to do that. And it's just so important.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, from my own investing journey, I started off as a hardcore fundamental analyst. You know, you look at the numbers, you look for opportunities to find things. And it wasn't until later in my career that I was really truly introduced to technical analysis. And, you know, it I understand, you know, and it was all Bill O'Neill with Investors Business Daily that I learned most of this. And, you know, there are great stocks, but there are great stocks that aren't a great buy at that time, you know. And
absolutely. I mean, one of the things I do, which when I actually did it, I had no idea how much value it was creating, but I got this book and I thought, oh, I'll put a couple of bonuses out with the book. And one is about how to invest. And the other is where the big funds are putting their money.
Yeah.
And, you know, who the main investors are in various companies. And that is phenomenally valuable because if you're like a novice investor and you don't really know what you're doing and you know, you think, oh, I want to put some money into, you know, a large multi-billion pound company. And you can see that BlackRock or, you know, a big investor has recently invested in that company, then I think, you know, you can kind of say, well, if it's good enough for BlackRock, it's probably good enough for me. Yeah. And you can, you know, they will have spent thousands of pounds on due diligence and got some very smart people doing it. Yeah. And, you know, a lot more than you or I could afford to do. And but what we can do is kind of piggyback off their knowledge and go, okay, well, they've invested in it. They invested at $12. Price is now $12-ish. I'm going to put some money in as well. And I think that's, you know, yes, it's nice if you do your own analysis, if you're capable of doing it. But if you're not, just piggyback off someone else who knows what they're doing.
Absolutely. Well, and I mean, you know, they're going to continue. I always look at, you know, when you're starting to look at your portfolio management and all that, well, I mean, look at in the United States, it's the S&P 500. Look at the top 50 stocks in the S&P 500. What's the common trend? Yes, you may see them drop, you may see them go back, but every week we have, you know, 401k contributions going into those S&P 500 funds every single week. And I think we've seen a change in the market because those are our, you know, that's you would call it a pension fund. We call it a 401k account, but that money is constantly coming in with every weekly paycheck. So, you know, you're just going to continue to see that, I think, go up over time, unless we see massive unemployment out there. Now you'll have periods where the market pulls back or whatever, but the odds are, if I look at it over a 5-year period of time, the left side of the chart's going to be lower than the right side of the chart.
Absolutely. I think there's a point on inflation here, which is actually very relevant as well to your listeners. Yeah. But, let's say I've got a company and my revenue goes up by 4%, and I've got record-breaking revenue. You know, I've done 100 million this year. Last year I did 99. So I've got a fantastic company. I'm growing the top line. But if inflation is running at 3-4%, I'm actually losing money. You know, my revenue is actually less than last year, but because of inflation, you're showing growth. And I think there's a lot of people who kind of get sucked into that and they go, you know, I'm investing in these companies, they keep growing, but do they? You know, it's like if they manufacture toothpaste and I tend to look at how many tubes they manufacture, and if they, let's say, do 10,000 this year and 10,000 this year and they did 11,000 last year, but their revenue has grown. I'm like, well, actually, they've underperformed because they've actually produced, even though their revenue's grown, they've produced fewer tubes of toothpaste and they've just increased the price.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and so it's kind of like people need to be a little bit savvy about their investments. And a lot of people don't have the time to do it or the inclination to do it. But I think that's where, in what I do, I show people how they can get equity research and not pay for it. And that can be very useful because you can kind of see, what companies are doing. And you go, okay, yeah, revenue's growing like that, profit's growing like that. But what are they actually doing? Are they making more stuff or are they making less stuff? And it's all relevant.
Well, I love the stat that you have on your LinkedIn profile that, you know, when getting back to gold, you know, it would have cost 340 ounces of gold to buy your average house in 1920. And in 2025, that's 140 ounces of gold at this point. So that tells the story right there.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer, honestly. You know, that 10.6 number I just flashed around as well. I mean, if you have any investment that generates that and is liquid, you know, insane. But going back to, you know, the initial thing, you know, I talk to people and they go, I love it, love it. Do you have any? No. And it's just, it's crazy. But I think people are waking up to that. But one of the problems that we have is that obviously last year the price went flying up, and I think people have missed the boat. And people think they've missed the boat. I don't think they have at all. They ain't going to get the best seat on it, but they haven't missed it.
And I mean, from a chartist standpoint, it's just ready to break through a support point. You know, it's been supported at basically the price where it's at today. It's hit that support point three times in the last, it was a resistance point, then it became a support point, and we're now busting through that support point again. So it's interesting for me from that perspective. So what's a good book that you'd recommend for our audience?
The Psychology of Money.
Okay. Interesting.
Brilliant book. Absolutely brilliant. There's a lot of psychology with money, and it's kind of like people, if they make a lot of money, they kind of like, it's easy, this is how I do it. But you can lose money, and I don't know, that I find money, it's fascinating, people, because it's a status symbol. You know, if you make a lot of money, you can buy a nice car, nice clothes, flash house, whatever it is. But I always think it's interesting to find out how they made their money. And I think that tells a lot about the person. And, you know, if they won the lottery or inherited it from their parents, I'd probably have a different view of them as an individual, as, you know, someone who's actually made the money. And if they've made the money, you know, have they made it? Have they just got lucky with a property and made a shitload of money, or have they sold a business? You know, I think there's a real undercurrent to any money story, whether it's good or bad. You know, there's certain people who invested everything they had in a great business concept, and it went to ratchet, and you know, they're living sort of on the breadline. But they're smart people, and there are also people without a brain who've made an awful lot of money. And you know, you could say they don't deserve it, but that's life. You know, it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Absolutely. What's a tool that you use in your business every day that you might recommend?
I use social media.
Okay, interesting.
I personally use LinkedIn, but I think any social media is fantastic, because it's like it's a platform that you can use to get your story out. And you know, if you're a business, or you know, whatever you're doing, you know, you can use social media to explain what you do and reach an awful lot of people. And it's a bit brutal, but it's good, because you could I can do a post on LinkedIn and think it's really good, and I can get very few views, or I could do one which I think is pretty average, and it takes me 5 minutes to put together, and I get thousands and thousands of views.
Yeah.
And there's no kind of, you know, I like to think, I know what I'm doing. And, you know, I'm much better than I used to be, but I'm still way off, you know, knowing what a post is going to do. Mm. And I think that's a really useful tool for businesses. Mm-hmm. And even if you're in a business where it's more business to business rather than business to consumer, that's why I quite like LinkedIn, because, you know, for example, I help companies also raise money for projects now and again. Mm. And I don't do it regularly, but LinkedIn is fantastic because I could look at, let's say, Pictet and look at sustainability management, and I can find the person who's dealing with that now.
Yeah.
I can contact them and say, hey, I've got this product. I think it could be right for you. It's sustainability management. They're like, you know, I've hit the bullseye.
Yeah.
And the old way of doing it, would you have a whole list of people who work for, let's say, Pictet, and you go, oh, I know Jeff. And then you contact Jeff and you find out he retired 5 years ago.
Yeah.
and you say, okay, well, you know, who's taken over the role? And you go, well, Susan. Okay, that's great. I'll speak to Susan. Then you find out Susan hates Jeff. You know, it's kind of like, okay, well, perhaps I'll just speak to, you know, whoever the right person is. And so, I think social media is a very, very useful tool.
That is fantastic. Last question for you. What is your definition of freedom?
My definition of freedom is doing what you want, when you want, how you want. And it doesn't mean not working. It might mean, you know, what I'm saying is you control what days you work, what hours you work, when you go on holiday. Freedom doesn't, it means different things to different people. And but I think freedom means you're basically doing what you want to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. And that may mean working for someone else. It might mean, you know, doing something that someone else doesn't consider to be freedom.
Yeah.
But I think freedom is very much about doing what you want to do and basically being happy. And I think there's a lot of people in jobs where I had a lovely saying where they get to the top of the job and they realize they took the wrong ladder. And but I think there's a lot of that in life where people, they fall into a career, they you know, they're good at it and they end up at the top of it. And suddenly when they hit their sort of probably mid-40s, they realize that they're in the wrong career. And you know, that's where you get people switching careers. And I certainly know people who went into investment banking because they happen to be very smart academic people and they've got the grades that investment bankers were looking for. And they did it. And they, after a while, they sort of, yes, they made a lot of money. They're very good because they're very smart people. But they went into teaching, which they probably earn about a tenth of what they used to earn. But that wasn't important to them. It was teaching kids. Yeah. And I think that you kind of need to find out sort of what you want to do. And one of the beauties of property and investment banking and, you know, a few things like that is you can get the money to take on a job that is, let's say, less well paid, that you might not want to do as you come out of university because you're never going to have enough money to buy a house or do other things you want to do. But I think that's it. Let's say you start off in investment banking and you go into education because that's what you want to do. I'd kind of describe that as freedom because you've got a job that you love. Hopefully you've got a house that you love, and so you might have even got a wife that you love and children you love. You know what I mean? And it's kind of like, it's a very good question, but it's I think freedom means different things to different people.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's why we ask, because we want to hear it from everybody. Well, Simon, thank you for being on the show today. I appreciate all that you talked about. What is the best way, if somebody wants to learn a little bit more about what you do, maybe some of the courses you do, where's the best way to find you?
If you have a look at the website, www.goldprogram.co.uk, there's a whole bunch of things that I do. And I think you just need to work out what's right for you. And get that. And then we get engaged and you're then on the journey. And, you know, I'm always there to help. And I've even got a money back guarantee. So if you buy anything and you're like, oh, I don't want this, you know, this isn't what I expected. It's get your money back and, you know, I don't care about it. But it's kind of like, well, I do care about it because if a few people do that, then I kind of go, well, you know, perhaps I need to change that, but it's never happened to me. But I think that If you're not sure about it, then you could always buy something and change your mind later on.
I love it. Well, Simon, thank you for being on. Appreciate you, and look forward to keeping up with you. I connected with you on LinkedIn. Make sure that we stay in contact because I respect what you do.
That's great. Well, lovely to be on, and thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. And folks, as always, make sure you subscribe to the channel and please give us an upvote if you liked it. And we will see you guys back here the very next time.
Thank you for listening to the Freedom Nation podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and all the major channels. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe to the channel and leave a rating and review. If you have friends and family that could benefit from their own Freedom Day, please share with them. Finally, join Freedom Nation by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.